brought to you by the Computer History Museum.
You're listening to CHM Live Radio. I'm Lauren Miyamoto, and I produce the museum's live speaker series. Each year, we bring incredible guests to the museum to talk about computing and the transformational effect it's having on our society. We've hosted a wide range of speakers, from geneticists and asteroid miners to technology giants like Elon Musk and Sheryl Sandberg. Today's episode features Chris Wanstroth. Chris turned a longtime passion for programming into GitHub, a social coding site that supports over 20 million users, including Google and NASA. They use the online platform to collaborate, build, and store software.
While technology has really helped us in many ways, like collaboration has gotten more difficult because we're all looking at our terminals alone, and you don't want to see my terminal. One of my favorite quotes is, "Hell is watching someone else like drive a computer."
So, how did Chris start GitHub? What are the most interesting projects being created on the site? Why is software collaboration important? Find out in this conversation between Chris and Fortune senior writer Michal Levram. It was recorded in January 2017.
Okay, Chris, so for the five people who raised their hand and don't know what GitHub is, can you tell us in your words?
So it's a lot of different things, but I think the main thing that GitHub is that really draws people is it's a website online that you can go to and you can find software, you can share software, but not only that, you can add to it, you can change it. And so there's this really thriving community of people that are building software all over the world that are connecting through GitHub, both public software that they want to share with the world, but also private software. Some of the companies mentioned Google, Facebook, NASA. A lot of NASA's code. Anyone can go see the code for some of the early Apollo missions, but I think some of the newer things they're working on you won't be able to see just quite yet. That's really what GitHub is about. It's essentially for people to collaborate on software together, and who you want to share it with is really up to you.
Give us a sense of scale also. How many lines of code have been, or terabytes of code, however you want to measure it.
Oh, I have no idea what that number is. But we have about 50 million projects on GitHub, and a project is defined by whatever you want. Linux itself, which has tens of millions of lines of code, that could be one project. A simple little JavaScript program to change slides, that could also be a project. And I think that is maybe what we're going to talk about in a little bit of the beauty of GitHub and software, is it's such a wide berth. There could be really simple things that are very elegant and solve a simple solution, but you could also have these massive projects that you've had tens of thousands of people literally working on together, and that's also something that can be represented, not just on GitHub, but as like an endeavor of human effort in software. So it's everywhere in between.
Every company, every startup has an origin story, and we'd like to hear yours. You were an English major dropout.
Oh, yes. that known.
So how did you start coding, and at what point did you realize that you liked writing code more than writing?
I sat down, and I set up a business plan, and I talked to investors. No, I think that's a really good question. When did I know? I was always one of those kids, maybe you have a kid like this, maybe you are this way, but I would like see a really good movie and be like, well, now I'm a director. Or I'd see like I'd hear a really good song and be like, well, now I'm a guitar player. And I think with software, I was the same way. I'd play a really fun video game or I'd see something really inspiring. I grew up in the era of Windows 95 right after DOS was sort of tapering out. And this was amazing. I want to make things move on the screen. How do I do that? So for me, it was less about being a programmer and more about how do I make things move on the screen. And the day at which I started enjoying that more than writing English was probably 8 or 9 years after I first started trying to become a programmer. There were so many false starts on, you know, I'm going to save up money from my paper route or like my mom's paper route, and then I'm going to buy this book on C++ programming, and I'm 12 years old, and none of this makes any sense, so I'm going to put that aside and go play soccer. Oh, now I'm going to try this new book on Perl, and there's all these different symbols. I don't know what that means. I'm going to put that down and go play basketball now. And then eventually I ended up in this wonderful language called PHP, an open source programming language. And for me, that really stuck. It was like probably my fourth or fifth time trying to be a real programmer. And it just stuck.
What was different that time around?
The community, really. I think everyone sort of learns in their own way. Some people work really well in a lecture setting. Some people work really well listening to a Q&A. Some people work really well hands-on. And PHP had the sweet spot of there was a book written by the main guy, so like, there was not a lot of errors in it. Rasmus wrote the book. I think he lives around here somewhere. And then there was a really like vibrant community online where I could ask specific questions about, I'm trying this thing, it's not working, and I would get an answer from someone. And the online community, the strangers on the internet, which I was growing up taught to fear, they ended up really helping me find a sense of a group, people trying to get the same thing, and they taught me so much. People, it never made any sense, right? Again, I'm used to strangers on the internet either, I don't know, trying to rob you, steal your identity, or, you know, say mean things because they just destroyed you in a game of StarCraft or Quake or whatever. But here was an online community, which is also somewhat negative at times, but they were trying to help share knowledge and build each other up and teach me things. And so I guess I enrolled in college to go I studied English. At the time, I knew I didn't want to do Flash. People remember Flash, of course. And I didn't want to do Java programming. And I couldn't go to school for PHP in the options that I had, so I went for English.
So you picked English.
I picked English. I figured whatever I did in life, I'd have to speak, read, write English. also, I've always been really into it. I really wanted to learn more about the language, I think, being someone that grew up native speaker. I didn't know anything about grammar, anything like that. So I thought it'd be a good skill to have. And then I found myself not going to school and skipping class. And instead of like doing drugs or whatever, I was programming. So my parents were equally mad at me. I didn't get a pass, but at least I'm not doing drugs. They'd be like, I don't care. You're failing everything. You might as well do drugs. At least you're having a good time. Instead, you're just like sitting on your computer. So that was kind of what I knew, I think, right around when I was failing out of college.
So wait, so you did a year, 2 years? How long did you
I made it about
survive?
A year and a half. I made it February of my sophomore year. So right around now, I think.
Okay. And then and at what point did you call up mom and dad and say, I'm dropping out and I'm going to Silicon Valley to San Francisco and starting a company?
Lord, no.
Are you with me?
No, Lord, no. No, I had great parents, and so they were not, I didn't think they were great at the time. I took them for granted. I was terrified of them. I would have never have told them that. Uh-huh. So what I did was I was not excelling in school, let's say, and I was spending a lot of time also on Wikipedia, just online stuff. I was really into Wikipedia. The whole platform was really coming alive at that time, and I can't harp enough on this internet community thing and how inspirational that
was. Were you contributing a lot to Wikipedia?
Yeah, I was contributing a lot to Wikipedia. And then Wikipedia was run on open source software called MediaWiki, mm-hmm. which was written in PHP. And so the whole Wikipedia thing end-to-end fascinated me. You could get into the guts of it. You could participate in the community. There was all this knowledge being shared on it. So I was really, really into that. And so I started, essentially I found potentially someone who maybe could have hired me through Wikipedia. I don't know. Again, this all sounds much more shady in retrospect than it didn't feel shady at the time. But I found someone on the internet who maybe would have hired me to work on some sort of media wiki modifications and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And so I had the idea that, like, if one person wants to hire me, maybe there's like two people that want to hire me, so I should try this thing out. So if any of you had a job recently, I did the thing that you did. I Googled like how to make a resume on Google, and I found a resume template. And I ended up tailoring it to be a lot of the open source projects and communities I'd been involved with instead of the jobs that I didn't have at this point. And so I put in some of my MediaWiki modifications I'd made. For references, I put some of the people that had mentored me with their permission, and it'd just be like a weird name and an email address, not as much a phone number. And then I sent this out to a couple companies using, I don't even know what was around at the time, monster.com or anything like that, probably 13 or 14 companies. And only two of them really called me back, but one of them was in, I grew up in Ohio. One of them was in New York. It was a trucking logistics company. Mm-hmm. I call it now Uber for truck drivers, which I don't think is a real thing yet, so no one take that. But like that's what it was ahead of the time, except they used fax machines. And they were trying to do this thing where you would fax in, I'm an independent owner operator of a truck, a big semi truck. I have a load that goes from Boston to Denver, and then I want to get from Jacksonville back to Boston. What's available between Denver and Jacksonville? And that was really what the software did, which is cool. I applied for that job. I was hired there. I signed up the W-2 or whatever. I started getting paychecks, and then I told my parents I was dropping out of school. Yeah, so
that's a good series of events. So did you move out to New York for this, or did you?
I did.
Stay in. You did.
Okay. I did. It turned out it was New Jersey, which is not New York.
It was a slight bait and switch.
Not New York. Yeah. No, it was Hackensack, little New Jersey. Yes, some people know. So it was not New York. At first, I worked from home, which at the time was called telecommuting. Now we call it remote work, but I was a telecommuter for a bit. which I was doing no commuting, and there was no Tella, but it was great because I still lived in Ohio, and I was making New Jersey salary, so that was wonderful. Uh-huh. And I was enticed to move out there, and yeah, I thought this was going to be great. I'm going to go live in the big city. I'm going to go learn how to be a better programmer surrounded by like these people that are doing really great work. And I lasted 2 days. It's not an exaggeration. I was there for 2 days in New Jersey. I drove 11 hours in my VW Jetta, and I got there. And I just realized at the time they were all mathematicians. Like, I guess trucking logistics is all about, I don't know, math. I'm not a math person. All the whiteboards were covered in symbols I'd never seen before. And at first, you're a beginning programmer, and you're like, oh, I'm going to learn what these symbols are. And you're like, that's not, none of that goes in PHP. This is math. It's like, you know, the little oval with the eye inside of it. Like, I don't know. You know, when the one's on top, and no, sorry. But a lot of math equations and stuff. It ended up being a very math-heavy culture, and I didn't feel like I was going to learn a lot about programming or progress in my career there. So after 2 days, I moved back to Ohio, yes. And then I ended up out here. I found a wonderful job at CNET, as John mentioned, at 2nd and Howard downtown SoMa in San Francisco, and actually the city. Mm-hmm. So it was actually in San Francisco, unlike the New York thing. And that worked out really well.
At what point, I mean, where did the idea come about for GitHub? How did you start, how did you guys start working on it? You had a co-founder initially.
Yeah, Tom. Tom and I started it together. You know, the funny thing about GitHub, and I think anyone who's done something that they're really proud of can say this, is like there's always that moment, that eureka moment that I can point to, but it's almost, it's fake. Like, the real idea for GitHub, if I look back, it started when I was young and I was learning to program, and I got over the initial hump of wanting to build video games and wanting to build stuff that just made money and figure out how to get out of Ohio. And I got to the place of wanting to write software that made an impact. And by that, I don't mean like, you know, solar-powered lights that changed the world. That would be cool. But I wanted to build something that someone I cared about would smile about. I wanted to like improve someone's life that I knew, and if that was me, that would be great. I care about myself, but if it was one of my friends or really a coworker, that's what really got me obsessed with software engineering. Is I could build something that it would make your life a little bit better. It would automate something, or it was a problem that you mentioned to me offhandedly, and I could write a little script to make that quicker. Like, that's when I really got obsessed with it, when I could see the impact it had on real people. And so. We started GitHub in 2007, October 2007.
How old were you?
I was 22.
So you were much older at that point.
I was very experienced. I had a couple failed enterprises under my belt. Yeah, I didn't know what I was
doing. 2 days in New Jersey.
2 days in New Jersey. I'd seen the big city. But, you know, leading up to GitHub, I'd worked on a wiki for some friends. I'd worked on a code hosting site. I'd worked on a way to get updates on software that you were watching. And so there was a conversation between Tom and I where we had the idea for GitHub. But he and I had independently worked on so many development tools to make programmers' lives better ahead of that I really think GitHub was really the culmination of what we had both been working on for a long time, and I also think the culmination of what a lot of early GitHub employees and GitHub users had been looking for, working on for a long time. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of people that came to work at GitHub came because the tool was really useful to them, and they had an idea to help make it better. And it wasn't that they just saw GitHub one day and suddenly they had this eureka. They'd been thinking about development problems. They'd been thinking about their own issues and their coworkers' issues for a long time. And so for me, this is all to say, I started working at CNET, and I was working at GameSpot.com, which is a video game website. And I already established that I love video games, and so that was a dream come true for me. And in a business plan, write out your life on paper sort of situation, I decided that I was going to transfer to the food website, Chow.com, because it was a smaller team. It was going to grow to be a top 100 website, I thought. I'd be able to see the whole thing. You know, how do you grow a website? How do you start something from scratch? How do you become a senior member of this team? How do you work with people that you don't really have a shared understanding with? I was eating a lot of Subway at this time.
I was going to say, do you love cooking?
I was 22, so like any good 22-year-old in San Francisco, I was eating a lot of Subway, a lot of mac and cheese. I made a lot of mac and cheese late at night. And on paper, this seemed like a really great career move, but when I got to Chow, I was like, I mean, again, I eat Subway, and I love Subway, but like that made me an outcast there in a way. And I was just so bored. I wasn't engaged with, I wasn't a member of the chow community. I wasn't caring about the best. I'd never had sushi at that point, probably. I wasn't arguing about convection versus whatever baking or any of these things. So I ended up at chow spending a lot of time on the development of chow and the development tools of chow. So it was kind of a blessing in disguise where I was so bored, I was looking for anything to do to keep me entertained. What kept me entertained were ways to build software better and reaching out to the community and getting more involved there. So chow really didn't turn out the way I expected it to turn out, but was like instrumental in starting GitHub, I believe.
How'd you meet Tom?
Online. I met a lot of strangers online.
Don't try that at home, people.
Tom was an open source developer as well. He was also a college dropout. He was in Southern California though, and he was working on an open source Ruby gem, or in the Ruby programming language, like a package. They call them gems. Programmers, if you don't know yet, they're very punny. Like, they're very into, like, themes and stuff. So, you know, Ruby has gems, Python has eggs.
Especially former English.
Especially, yeah, we're trying to, like, find an outlet for our creativity, right? Us English majors that didn't do our homework. So, yeah, he was the author of a Ruby gem that I used. Uh-huh. And then one day he came to San Francisco and was interviewing at a company that I was consulting at. And so I met him that way. And then we ended up not becoming friends through that. That's how we met. We would go to a lot of Ruby meetups. And then there was one time after the meetup, a bunch of us went out for beers, and Tom and I were talking, and I had recently given a presentation around Git or GitHub, and he had maybe copied mine or something. No, he was also interested in Git and GitHub, and Git and version control, and he had registered GitHub.com, and he sort of pitched me on this idea, like, hey, I know you're really into this thing. I have this great idea. It's for this thing called GitHub. And the way that...
So explain Git.
Explain Git.
Yeah.
Yes. People are laughing because...
Because not everybody,
No one can explain Git. It's a lot like Wikipedia, I think, conceptually, uh-huh. In that you go to Wikipedia. This is true. So Wikipedia is like two things. There's the MediaWiki software, and then there's the content of Wikipedia. And so you can imagine a website like Wikipedia where everyone is collaborating not on encyclopedia information, but on movie scripts or a journalist's story or your autobiography or a book that you're writing. You put up the information, people go onto the website, they edit it, you can see who changed what, you can see when it was changed. This is all through the exact same software that powers Wikipedia. It's really Wikipedia's choice that they're doing it for an encyclopedia. And they actually do this. They have that news website, Wikinews, I guess, I forget what it's called. The one I use more, Wiktionary, which is their dictionary/thesaurus. And it's the same software, but they're using it for different purposes. Git and version control, more broadly, is not dissimilar from that in concept. It's that instead of doing the Wikipedia thing with an encyclopedia article or a movie script or a book, you're doing it with software. And the reason you're doing it isn't to get everyone to come in and say something about how George Bush is a lizard or whatever on your public software. It's to back up your software. It's to see who made what change. It's to test things in production. Maybe we want a version of this that's blue and a version of this that's green, and we want to roll them out concurrently and see who clicks it more or whatever. You've heard of this stuff before, probably. Git and version control systems can really help you do that. Okay, green's the winner. We're not going to lose any work. Now we can roll over to green. But more importantly, what it lets you do is collaborate with people all over the world that you've never met before. And so you could have, before on the drive down, you could have been working on a piece of software that I've never seen before. And right here on stage, you could say, you should check out my Git repository. Here's the URL. And then if I had a laptop, I could just pull down your code.
I actually did.
You did. No. So this is not staged. But your GitHub URL. So anyway, you could show off the URL of the Git repository. I could pull down the code. I could start messing with it. And then I could, in exchange, share with you a URL of the changes I've made. You can evaluate them. You can pull it in. And so it's a lot of the power of the collaborative software, the collaborative idea behind Wikipedia, but people use it to build software. And it's one of these things, I think the reason I'm up here and the reason GitHub is so spectacular and the reason our community is so spectacular is that's like the technical, well, not really, but that's like kind of the technical explanation for what Git is like, here's what it does, but that misses the whole point. The whole point is what Git does, and what's magic about Git is it lets people build things together all over the world using their computers. And like, there has never been a system so easy, so universal, so powerful as Git before, and I'm biased, but I really believe that. And I think that GitHub has a lot to thank Git for, and we've tried to give back in many ways, but Git is about more than a Wikipedia for code. It's about more than, let me see your changes and I'll edit them back. It helps people work together. And I think one of the tragedies of, you know, like the era that we're in the Computer History Museum, is we've gone so far in technology, we've gotten so many advancements on, you know, I can like see your text on my watch, there's now all this great medical technology, we've got self-driving cars, but everything that humans have created, that we've created together. Like this chair, this is silly, but like this, everything is created by a team. This chair is created by a team. This microphone was created by a team. This table was created by a team. And a lot of times it's two or three people or more sitting around arguing about the table, right? We've all been there. But with computers, with all this forward technology, it's really hard for us to sit around a laptop and argue as much as we want to. It's really hard for me to write a piece of software and for you to come over to my desk and like look at it and evaluate it. And so while technology has really helped us in many ways, like collaboration has gotten more difficult because we're all looking at our terminals alone and you don't want to see my terminal. One of my favorite quotes is, hell is watching someone else like drive a computer, right? Like you're like, no, don't click that. No, click the shift button. No, don't do that, right? Like no one wants to watch anyone else use a computer. And Git helps solve that problem. Git is one of these tools, and there are a bunch of them, and they try to make it easier for people to work together on a computer. And this is still a really unsolved problem, and I'm a big believer in technology, but it's still not easy enough. And this is one of the things that we're losing as we get so much more technology. As things get so better, it's still so damn hard just to work together on stuff. And that's one of the problems GitHub is trying to solve for software. And like, if we are having this, not to scare everyone, but if we're having this problem working still together on software, like what hope is there for people working on Excel or people doing CAD software? Like if you use any of these tools, you know how isolating it can be compared to like, let's just get on a piece of paper and look at it. And so we're trying to help solve this problem with software, but I think that technology really has a long way to go in solving the collaboration problem overall.
So Git existed, version control existed,
yeah.
Was the revolutionary element to what you guys were doing, the collaborative piece of it, or what was it?
Git existed. Git is an open source piece of technology written by, this is also not an exaggeration, written by the person that created Linux. Mm-hmm. So he's like two for two so far. Yeah. Linus Torvalds created Linux in the early 90s, released it as open source software. Anyone could view it, anyone could see the code, anyone could use it. The rules were you have to attribute it to him, you can't change the copyright, and you can't break the other rules, which there's a bunch of them. But essentially you could use it however you wanted. There's a lot of drama in programming communities. So if anyone is like working on a TV show that's a soap opera and needs ideas, you should go to the issue in which the Linux community was no longer able to use the version control system they were using. They were using one for a while called BitKeeper, and then a bunch of drama erupted, and then they stopped using it, and you can fill in the blank there if you want. And so they had to find a new tool to manage Linux, which is this massive, massive, massive software project, and so Linus created Git to do it. But Git is one of many. There was version control systems going back to the 70s, and they evolved, and it's really quite fascinating if you're a version control geek like me. At first, it was like a single file, and then you could do a directory, and then you could do like two directories, and then you could do more and more.
You should curate like a whole exhibit
like
here,
a museum.
Just on version control.
I know a little bit about it. Yeah, it's really interesting, and there's a lot of prior art, and they're all built on top of each other. That's one of the other really cool things about it is Git is built on concepts that have been around for a while, and Linus and his team really nailed the execution. But yeah, Git was an open source project, and so I was really drawn to Git being trying to fill my time at Chow while I was bored, trying to find new ways to work with other developers, just looking at cool stuff. And I think what GitHub did, so Git is this tool that it's like a standalone tool, you get it on your laptop, you can use it, it's open source, but there's no GitHub for Git by default. Git was just, you download it, you run it, you're on your own. You have to publish your URL, you have to create a server, you have to do a lot of that work. Linux, of course, being this massive project, they have the infrastructure. I don't have servers, you don't want me securing anything. And so What GitHub really did was make Git accessible to the English dropouts of the world, the people that wanted to write software, we wanted to collaborate, but I'm not a Linux kernel. You don't want to trust me with anything related to the Linux kernel. I'm not writing security software. I'm not like a hardcore assembly engineer. I'm not in the Computer History Museum, but I still want to like mess around and do stuff and maybe make a website that, you know, charges you money or something like that. I don't know, but there's a lot of developers out there that, you know, we just want to work with other people and we want it to be done in an easy way, but we don't want our tools to be dumbed down. And for me, and I think a lot of us, Git was the best of both worlds. It's, in my opinion, the best version control tool possible, and we could make it accessible to, you know, a 12-year-old writing their first line of code, and that's really the dream of GitHub.
You guys raised a lot of money. You started accumulating, you know, bigger and bigger customers. Is there some, like, magic tipping point where things really accelerated for you guys?
I think the tipping point for me was having lived in San Francisco, seeing the insanity around the startups and all that. And like on the one hand, it's all ridiculous and there's like an app to, I don't know, let you know when your dog goes to the bathroom or something and they got $100 million. But on the other hand, you start to see stuff that's like Google Maps. And that's like really making an influence and actually doing something real in the world that the previous generation of software companies weren't doing. Because like when I grew up, and a lot of, I think when we grew up, we were, software to us was something running on a machine and a desk in a basement probably. And now you have software starting to run everywhere. And so that to me was more of the realization around like, oh, well, I'm starting to see now that software is becoming a bigger deal. And really what GitHub is about, it isn't about these Ruby meetups. It isn't about someone connecting a game controller to a computer. It isn't about GE producing whatever jet engines. It's about whatever people want to do with software. Like, we want to help you do whatever. And it could be this simple thing, or it could be this really epic thing. It could be the Linux with tens of thousands of users, or again, it could be the little boy writing his first little Android app. Like, we want it to work for all of them. And I think once we had these two things in mind, which is like, we want GitHub to be agnostic to software, but in a positive way, and we think software is going to be like the biggest thing in the world, that was the clicking point. It was really the like community around us growing that made us think we could have a bigger impact.
So that's on the software side of things.
Yeah.
In terms of actually starting and running the company, so you're still at this point in your early, mid-20s, right? Early 20s, I guess.
Right now?
No.
Yeah, 10 years ago.
Yeah, 10 years ago. And you were the original CEO, then one of Tom, co-founder, became CEO, then you became CEO again. But you're a CEO, basically, in your
twice,
early...
two times, yeah.
Yes. Second time's the charm.
I hope so.
So you become a CEO in your early 20s. The company, of course, is very small to begin with. You're now, what, like 600 employees or so?
Yeah, we're 600 people.
What in your background helped you lead a company, if anything?
Nothing. That's probably why I had to come back and be CEO a second time. Oh man, that's a great question. Nothing. Nothing could have prepared me for this and for that. And if anything, I was underprepared in many ways. And not in a like, oh, I was so lucky that I did it well. Like so many things. If anyone wants to start a company, let me know. Send me an email. I have a lot of advice. Like, we screwed up so many things in the early days. And I think part of our success is what led us astray. This is this fundamental belief in software being able to solve all problems, and this idea that, you know, a lot of the traditional company ideas we don't need because we can just write software to do it. And maybe part of that is still true, and I believe that. But like writing software has a cost. It has a time cost. It has a maintenance cost. It has a brain cost. And do you really want to write your own version of Excel because you think you can? I don't know. I don't know what we were thinking. But we thought we could solve all problems with software. And so I think that was a good thing and a bad thing. It let us down. Like, GitHub wouldn't be here if we weren't naive idealists, I think. I don't think we would have ever started the company without a view on, like, how are we going to make money? Is there even going to be a future for this? You know, we just thought it was cool, and we would use it, and our friends would use it. And if that was the failure scenario, that would be a pretty great place to leave things. But I think what really prepared me for, I don't know if leadership is the right thing that I was prepared for, but being a user, being in the community, starting a company with people that were also in the community, like that was the thing that saved us and got us to this point, or was one of the major things, is the fact that, do you ever like rent a car at an airport and you're like, has the CEO of this company ever rented a car? Has like the person in charge ever experienced this? Because I just don't believe it. Like, because I just feel like if you went through the whole, obviously there's like the premiere thing where they've got your keys waiting for you, whatever. But if you go through the whole song and dance of like renting a car, yeah, it's not the worst thing in the world, but you just see so many, and you have the time to think about it, right? You just see all the little inefficiencies and you're like, like the people running this company, I don't know if they're users. I don't know if they're customers. And no offense if anyone works at a rental car company, but I think that was one of the things that really helped us and really prepared us and really we can attribute a lot of GitHub's success to is the fact that like we were using, and I still use the site every day, but we were using the site every day to build the site and to build, more importantly, other sites, because we were not making money. And so I was contracting. Tom was working at a startup, search startup using GitHub. And so we were, you know, the first line of the nice way to say it is feature requests. The other way to say it is like feature demands. And so we were our own, you know, really demanding customer. And I think that's probably the biggest thing that helped us was, you know, using our own software. Some people will say, eat your own dog food. I don't eat dog food. I don't understand what that means. So we sometimes say drink your own champagne. It's something I learned from someone. But yeah. But I think, you know, drinking your own champagne, bottling your own water, whatever you want to say, I think doing that is the thing that really prepared us. Nothing really prepared us for the business side of it.
In terms of setting the culture, I mean, give us the good, the bad, and the ugly. Obviously, you guys had some challenging times internally. You took over at some point for your co-founder when you returned as CEO. Maybe tell us about OctoCat.
So the OctoCat is our mascot, and it's weird. It's a cartoon cat. You probably wouldn't associate it with a version control Git software company. But when we were starting GitHub, there was a trend for like a 404 page, like you know, like the article's gone or the thing you were looking for isn't there anymore. That's a 404 page. And then there's a 500 page, which is like the website broke. It's not your fault. And I don't remember what they were before, probably as boring as I just explained them, but when we were first starting GitHub, there was a trend to do funny 404 pages. And so, I don't know, like a boat in the middle of a parking lot, and it's like you're lost, right? And you're like, haha, why would, anyway. So that was a trend that was going on, like a little bit of humor on 404 pages. So we wanted to spice up our 404 and our 500 pages, especially because we thought people would be landing on them quite often, because Git is complicated, and you can delete stuff and everything, and we would break our own website a lot, and so we're like, these pages are going to get a lot of views. Mm-hmm. And so in Git, so we found the OctoCat, and we put the OctoCat on the 404 page and the 500 page. And the way we got to the OctoCat, this is so convoluted, I'm sorry, but you brought it up. So in Git, there are, so you can have different lines of development, they're called branches. And so I used the example before, there's a green version, there's a blue version. I have a branch that's blue, I have a branch that's green, and then maybe green's the winner, and that becomes the main one, right? So you can do like 50 branches, you can do 100 branches, I wouldn't recommend it, but people use Git for this. And so when you want to bring the histories back together, it's called a merge. And so if you make a change while I'm doing something, and I want to bring it into my version, I'll merge that in. And so Git is good enough that it can do multiple merges. It can do one merge with multiple lines of history. And the thing is it swaps out the algorithm depending on how many lines of history you want to merge together. And so the default algorithm is like two or three lines.
This is the most complicated story about a mascot I've ever heard.
It's going to get good. Yeah. I promise that you'll remember this to the day you die. Then there's like one for two to five. But the one for like five to eight merges is called the octopus merge strategy. And so we were one day bleary-eyed reading Git documentation, just like, what are we doing with our lives? And we see the word octopus. And we're like, oh, that's interesting. So Git has some sort of like very stretched animal associated with it. We need to find something hilarious for our 404 page. We're going to find an octopus. Like, this is the kind of conversation you have at like 4 o'clock in the morning after you've been drinking Red Bull working on Git software all night. Okay, I promise it made sense at the time. But we went to iStock Photo, and for $5, we got a license to the OctoCat that this person drew. And we put that on our 404 page. And then we took the OctoCat, and we flipped her frown we flipped her smile upside down to be a frown, and we put that one on our 500 page, the error page, was a frowning OctoCat. And then people started really getting into the OctoCat and talking about it and tweeting about it, and we thought it was just going to be this little Easter egg, and it turned into this thing that people were latching onto, where they were like, do you have stickers, or like, I think GitHub is stupid, but I like the OctoCat, so I'm going to, can I get a sticker? And we're like, well, that's amazing, right? So people were now at first using GitHub in spite of Git because it's difficult, and now they're loving the OctoCat in spite of GitHub. So it was a real positive signal for us. So eventually we bought the exclusive rights to the OctoCat. We now own it.
So no one else can have them.
No one else can have them. Like, the OctoCat is not GitHub. It's you. And it's not supposed to be like a person or too much like your, you know, your crazy red mop of hair and like, oh, it's my Nintendo Mii character. The Octocat is supposed to represent like a person in a community, and it doesn't matter like who you are, what you look like, or where you came from. It matters like what you're trying to do with other people. And so we think of GitHub as a community of like Octocats trying to work together. And so what we'd love to do in the future is like let you make your own Octocat and have different flavors of Octocats. And the one that, this is a tidbit for anyone in the room, not a lot of people know this. So there's actually an entire species of Octocats, including Octokittens. And the one that you see most often, her name is Mona Lisa. And so it's a female Octocat named Mona. And so Mona Lisa.
It's a frown, it's not a smile. Now we finally know.
It's a range of emotions.
Uh-huh. You've had to significantly grow the company. You've also, I mean, you guys have raised hundreds of millions of dollars from venture capitalists. And with that comes a lot of responsibility. So how have you, I'm not so much talking on the technology side now, but more on the culture side and the leadership side, how have you managed to sort of scale yourself along with the company?
In the early days, it was a lot around like, what do we think the future is? I'm the number one user of GitHub. So like, what do I think the future is? And it turned out we've shipped a lot of stuff that way that people didn't really want, and it wasn't the future. And when, you know, that's sort of like a cognitive dissonance you have to deal with when you think you're the best thing in the world and like no one else does. You're like, well, are they all wrong? Or am I wrong? Well, I can't be wrong. So it must be all of them, right? So we had to, like, our culture was set up around that. Like, we eat our own dog food or whatever. You know, we know what's going on. We're like super in touch. And maybe you can do that when you have a company that is going to get as big as we wanted it to get, which is like 1,000 users. But GitHub got to be so big that we just got totally out of touch with our community. Like, yeah, I maybe could speak for a small percentage of the Ruby on Rails and the PHP community, but now we have Java developers working at Procter & Gamble that are trying to do like awesome enterprise software, like working with chemical systems, and what they want, I don't even know what any of that means. And so what they want out of GitHub is something very different than what I want out of GitHub. They're still a software developer. They still want to work with someone else and build great tools, but they work in a different environment. They have different ideas. Maybe it's a NASA engineer, maybe it's people working completely distributed, maybe it's people all working in the same office, but you just get to this point where your customers are not the people in the building, the 12 people in the building. And we were able to put off that reality for a long time. And then it really caught up with us on the cultural stuff, a lot of which is very public, that we screwed up. The product, also very public, that we screwed up. The direction, leadership changes, a lot of that. And I think a lot of it was really just like not being maybe mature enough to understand what was happening around us. So I think that we had to learn that the hard way, in some ways very publicly, in other ways not publicly, but super painfully. And what really clicks is like, it doesn't have to be a painful lesson. Like, it's not bad to realize that you're not the smartest person in the world. It's like, that's one way to look at it. The other way to look at it is like, you are in the middle of this community of some of the smartest people in the world, and they're telling you what they want, and all you have to do is listen, and all you have to do is figure out how to give them what they want. And I know that we don't always do that, but I think if you look at the past 2 years of GitHub, we're getting a lot closer to that. And some of the launches we did last year in particular, I'm really, really proud of, because I think even as we get big, even as we raise hundreds of millions of dollars and we try to get the Fortune 10 and whatever, I was at a conference where we released something new, and I had a high school kid come up to me. He and his dad flew from Arizona to come to the GitHub conference, and he was really excited about one thing that we'd shipped that day. And this was 4 months ago. And like, to me, that says that we're getting back to the right spot, is that we're making things for people who are doing very professional work, very enterprise level military stuff, Procter & Gamble, let's say. But also, again, like I've kind of been saying, we're still helping people who want to become programmers, the next generation. We're helping them like get their footing and not have to go through a lot of the BS that I had to go through to get there, and really connecting them with everyone. And like, that kid, I want to hear what that kid's feature requests are more than I ever want to hear about my own feature requests, or honestly, the feature requests of a GitHub employee. And I think that is how the culture has been changing a lot in the past couple years. And I think we are a stronger company for it. I think the product is stronger for it, and I think it's only going to get better. And like, it's so simple, right? Like, I say it up here, and it sounds so simple, but like, the answer was looking us in the face the whole time. It's like, the community is who we're building stuff for, and so we should just ask them what they want us to build. And we're not going to do it all, but you know, we just thought we were so great for such a long time, and it really hit us hard. And I'm really glad we learned that lesson, and I'm really proud of like how far the company has come. And I hope some of you like some of the stuff we did last year, and I hope you're going to like the stuff we do this year. But like, we're really doing it for developers, and that's probably, for me, like some of the biggest cultural pillars that we've had to adjust and figure out and really like what we talk to new people about. And I think what a lot of the people that have been at the company for a long time are still really proud of is like the emphasis on the developer, any size and shape, wherever they are in their career. And the way we can make that real is just go out and talk to them. And I think that's like maybe a simple way of looking at it, but the biggest cultural transformation for me, aside from all the, you know, the way we want to work and telecommuting and are we do video, are we async on Slack and all that, it's all important. But I think it's almost like, you know, people talk about the mission or the vision or the guiding North Star principles. Our North Star in the early days was a lot about make something great for the developers in the building. And now the North Star is make something great for every developer in the world. And I know that's impossible, but I think that like, I think Larry Page or someone of these people who are pretty well accomplished has this great quote that like, I don't know, maybe it was my third grade English teacher, but like, you know, it's cool to have, it's good to have impossible goals because if you miss it, you're still going to do something pretty remarkable. Like when our goal was get a bunch of people in SF using Ruby on Git, if we failed at that, we were left with just ourselves using Git, which at the time was fine. But now if our goal is to make GitHub great for every developer in the world, I don't think we're ever going to hit that. Maybe we can, but if we miss that and we make GitHub great for, you know, 4 billion people or 3 billion people or however many developers there are in the world, I think that's something that we'll all be really proud of and hopefully developers will really find useful.
How is it different today versus 10 or so years ago when you were finding your way?
Yeah, it's in some ways it's more difficult today, I think, because there are so many more things. I guess this is the like vague cliche answer. But I think like the heart of it is that like we joke, we want to put ourselves out of business. Don't quote me on that. But like GitHub is all about people.
Your VCs like that?
No, they hate that. But they like but like GitHub and software development and a lot of, I think, probably what's in the awesome exhibit that's going to open that I'm excited to see, the history of software, it's a lot, the emphasis is a lot on software and programming and code and these tools and like Atom the text editor with Git the version control system and da-da-da-da-da. And again, it's all these like technical things that interlock and you have to learn and master and like where do I even go to discover these tools and whatnot. And it's all it's important, but it sort of all distracts and dilutes from the real point. And I think the reason a lot of people start working with software, which is like, here's a screen and it's blank and I want to put something on it. And now the screens are iPads and phones and watches and here. And when I was a kid, it was just a desktop computer in my basement. But I think the sentiment is still the same is, I see Angry Birds, I want to make that. Or I see a problem, I want to solve it. Or I see an opportunity, and I want to go to that. And I think a lot of these conversations that you have around with people, like the way in which we get there is through software. But really, like all good software exists to do something. It's to solve a problem, it's to get you somewhere. And I think that in that way, is now it's like the best time ever to become a programmer or a software engineer. Because even though there's a lot more to learn, and even though it's a lot harder, it's so much more powerful. There are so many more things you can do. I mean, you can make the lights change in your house if you buy the right bulbs and program it, and that's a silly example, but 10 years ago that was science fiction. And so the other side of that is like, what kind of health data can you get off of this watch or whatever other medical devices there are coming out? What kind of like, one of the cool things right now is on GitHub, like when I was becoming a programmer, all of the open source projects I could find were for software developers, basically. And that's largely true. It was software developers making open source projects for software developers. Now there are, software is like such a big part of life, there are open source projects that are just by nonprofits or just groups that don't even have an organization behind them that are trying to do something in the world that's for good. And so one example is Stephen Hawking has that machine that makes him talk. And the way he does it is through his eyes. He looks and he basically types with his eyes. That software is open source. It's on GitHub, but it's open source, and that's the important point. And it's built by Intel, and a lot of people work on it. And the fact that like that sort of software that's actually helping someone, improving their quality of life, especially someone with a disability, and that's open source, and anyone can walk in and contribute to that, like that blows my mind, and that's really amazing. And so for you to want to become a software engineer or a programmer or a developer, yeah, you can go look at my JavaScript to change slides in a presentation. Yeah, you can go look at, you know, GitHub's open source for how we route your Git repository to a different server. Or you can go look at the code that Stephen Hawking uses to talk. And I feel like that is the thing that is like so important and not to be overlooked is all the things we're doing around code and better software and computers, it's all to do something. And the somethings that we can do in the world have never been as powerful or as real with software as they are today. And so it's really, really exciting to me to talk to someone who's like, you know, 5 years ago they would say, I want to get started in software, what do I do? And I was like, maybe you do like video games, you can make a mod for Minecraft. Mm-hmm. And now it's like that's one example. There's another example. There's this big open source project doing health records in Africa because there's no centralized sort of like health system across an entire continent. And so there's open source projects doing things that are essentially social good. And you don't even have to even know what the cause is or have even been to Africa to just go look at the code, learn from it, contribute to it to do something in the world. And then the other side of that is, yes, there are medical nonprofits in Africa trying to do good, but then you can see a bunch of Facebook's code. And so you also have some of the biggest, most profitable companies like Apple that are, you know, that are for-profit organizations that are also releasing open source, like the Swift programming language that now more and more iOS programs are using to run, and that's all open source, all available on the internet. So I guess the point I'm trying to make is like the tools I feel like are more difficult. Maybe I'm a part of that. I don't know. But it's really, there's a lot of stuff you have to do to become a programmer, to write software and to code, but like the incentives and what you can do with it have never been more powerful. So I think it's a really great time to learn. And I what I want to try to do is, like, for every kid like me who maybe was bored in school and somehow got into programming and ended up where they are, like I was really lucky to meet the right mentors online, like, how many other kids never met that mentor or never found that message board and tried programming, you know, and gave up on the fourth time instead of going to time number 9 like me? And so I'm hoping with GitHub that we can help. I mean, there's a lot of things I want to do with it, but I'm hoping that one of the things we can do with GitHub is help those kids, like really younger people, find something that really sparks their imagination and is interesting and gets them into, honestly, the mundane awfulness that is software development, because they want to do something powerful with it. And that was, I mean, I know there's software developers in the room, and I'm sorry, but it's a really tough craft, and a lot of it just sucks. And a lot of people get into it because they want to do something great with it. And you're able to like dig through a lot of the bad stuff and be bleary-eyed at 4 a.m. because, you know, you might not be interested in the way that Git stores its file formats, but you want to help people collaborate on software together. And so I really think the power and like the secret to getting people more involved with software, a lot of it's easier tools. A lot of that is what we're trying to do every day. But I think the real magic is like helping people spark their imagination by showing them what can be done and helping them find something they want to do. Maybe they don't want to work on social good. Maybe they want to just work on airplanes. But like, there's software for that too. And so I think that this is the best time ever, obviously, to work on software, because software is so impactful and it's never been more powerful. And it's also, I really believe, just the beginning. I think if we look at like, you write a biography of the 19th or the 20th century, and a lot of it's going to be like 1917, right? It's all about hardware. It's about Ford, and there's all these big machines and industrial revolution and da 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 da. And like, what is it going to be right now, 100 years from now? It's going to be software. Like,
what's the in this world view and in what you guys are doing internally, who you're hiring internally? What's the importance of a college degree, if at all? I mean, it was founded by two guys who dropped out of college and wanted
allegedly,
to code, but yeah.
Allegedly, yeah.
Do you care? I mean, when you're hiring people?
Care? I'm not going to hold... Yeah, we care.
It's about their educational background, I mean. What
I think
do
it depends.
About?
I think it depends. So, I mean, if you... It depends. It depends, right?
You just don't want to say that college is irrelevant.
No, it's not irrelevant. I don't think it's irrelevant. Like, if someone walks in the door for a software engineering job and they have a CS degree, that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. I think that's amazing. We don't hold that against them. But if someone walks in the door... Like, college is experience, right? Like, people know this. So if someone walks in the door and they have no open source resume and no college degree, I mean, we're not going to hire them. Like, they have, show us something. If you walk in the door and you have a college degree but no open source experience, well, maybe we'll take a chance on you. In the same way, if you walk in the door and you have open source experience but no college degree, we're going to take a chance on you as well. I think a lot of it, for us, the resume is really about like getting you in the door. Mm-hmm. And then once you're in the door, once you're talking to people, it's a lot around, well, A, like, do you think we're all Looney Tunes, or do you actually believe in this future of software and that we can make a small contribution to it? What do you think of what we're trying to do? What do you think the future of the company is? And then how well do you work in this environment that we're in, where, you know, only half the company is in San Francisco and we use a lot of these tools and whatnot? And I think for software in particular, like, a degree is one way to show that someone has experience in has been through things, but it's not the only way.
Mm-hmm. So, and I'm not at all saying that college is irrelevant, don't get me wrong, but for you guys, I mean, you can, I'm assuming that probably a large percentage of the developers who you hire are on GitHub, so you can actually see their code before you hire them.
Yeah, right? Yeah. A lot of them do. A lot of them are in the open source world, and so we can see their code. I mean, it is a little trickier if they worked for a private company and they can't show the code. And so, like in that situation, okay, I've been a developer for 5 years. I worked for Boeing. I can't show you any of my code. Well, what can you show me? Well, I have a college degree, and I, you know, you can call my manager a reference. Like that it does help. It doesn't matter. My only dogma is no dogma. How about that? So okay. We try to take things as, you know, if you went to the best college in the world and got a 4.0, that says something about you. If you don't have a college degree and you've done a bunch of great stuff and worked for a bunch of great companies, that also says something about you.
Okay. All right. So we're gonna transition over to your questions, and we'll try a new challenge for you. So you have to answer these in one sentence.
Okay.
And it can't be a run-on sentence. Okay?
And.
All right. Compare GitHub and SourceForge.
Oh, you can't do that in one sentence. Was that my sentence?
Do you want to pass? You can pass once. You get one pass.
SourceForge was the precursor to GitHub in that it was an open source community where people could share open source code and build communities and work together. And it's where I learned how to do open source through SourceForge, with the main difference being that SourceForge was public only and advertising driven. And so SourceForge's business model and a lot of their decisions were based on an advertising driven model, whereas GitHub's model is that we charge people to host private code, and so you, the user, are our customer, and so our business decisions are around the person who's using the software and not the advertiser. And in that way, I think that we have a stronger business model. But I owe everything to SourceForge, and I'm a huge fan of what they've done.
Did you read a lot of Faulkner when you were in school? Okay, where does GitHub get revenue?
We charge people and companies to host private code.
What is the geographical distribution of your users? What trends have you seen in that? That can be two sentences. It's two questions, really.
Thank Lord. Okay, that's a great question. So only 30% of GitHub users come from North America. It's a very international community. It's always been extremely international. So probably, I don't know the exact numbers, probably around 30%-ish from Europe, 30% North America. Mm-hmm. So that is the broad, we have blog posts that give more real answers than that. So that's the first sentence. So the second sentence is, we've doubled in the past year in China, doubled in the past year in India, in sort of non-North American, non-European sort of parts of the world. They are also experiencing an explosion in the growth of software. And kind of like I was saying before, where software explodes, GitHub tends to benefit from that. We explode too. And so we can sort of see where software is eating the world and where it's blowing up in an industry by just looking at our own growth. And you know, the past year, mm-hmm. again, what's been surprising is there's such massive countries, China and India, and they seem to have really good technology. You see a lot of Alibaba and all these really famous, really well-run technology companies, and yet they're still growing so fast. It's really remarkable.
Any surprising hotspots that you're seeing?
Africa, really. There's a large, or I guess relatively speaking, a large and growing, not just tech culture in Africa, but startup culture in Africa that we're trying to get a lot closer to. Mm-hmm.
Okay. When will GitHub's own code appear on GitHub?
I'm going to give the dodge answer on this. So basically, GitHub is itself not open source, and we get a lot of criticism for that because we host open source. But you know, there's a lot of shades of gray in between that. So we are one of the biggest open source like communities on GitHub. So if you look at the top 10 open source communities on GitHub, Microsoft is up there, believe it or not. Apple is up there. Google's up there, obviously, with Chrome and whatnot. And we are up there with a lot of our own technologies. And so while GitHub itself, you can't download and run your own GitHub.com. That is, at its core, closed. We are huge proponents of open source. We do tons of open source. We have some of the biggest open source projects out there. And when will GitHub itself become open source? I mean, never say never. The historical thing has been, it's a lot of work, and we don't think that that's the best use of our resources right now to make GitHub itself open source, to run a really good open source community, which is super time consuming and not something to be taken lightly.
But where is software going in 10 years? And you could even rephrase that to, where's the world going in 10 years in some ways?
I think like the ways in which software is going to, the way in which software is going to change our lives and our society, we don't even know yet. We've got no idea, and I really can't predict yet. And because the way it's going to change us is going to be non-linear. It's not going to be like we have a car today, and in the future it's going to fly. It's going to be more like we have these machines today, and in the future we're always going to be connected to the entire world in our pockets. And it's hard for us to make those sorts of leaps because it's not linear from the first microchip to an iPhone in your pocket with LTE, but when those things come together, when those technologies come together, what you get out of it isn't an iPhone in your pocket or an Android in your pocket with LTE. It's being connected to the world and to your family and to everyone. And like all of a sudden we wake up, it's 2017, most people have a smartphone, the world has changed, fake news, da-da-da. Like it's impacting the way we talk to each other and we experience the world around us. And we just started, like software just got here. And so what is software gonna do in 10 years? I don't know exactly, but I know it's going to only become a more positive force in the world. And so what I'm trying to do and what GitHub is trying to do is give more people access to that power and to that software, give more people agency over it. I mean, I'd love to see a world where 3D printing is so cheap and ubiquitous that you have people anywhere in the world and what they want to do is like fix a faucet, or you know, you can be your own plumber, or you can be your own like print out a little Hot Wheels car, or you can be like print out a clock and program it and just do whatever you want. Like, why is that so hard to imagine? I don't think it is. I just think that the way in which software is going to affect the world is going to be such a change that you can't take a linear, we're going to have flying cities now. It's just going to like, it's going to be the thing where like, you know, I'm going to be talking to my grandkids and telling them I walked up to school both ways in the snow, right? Like, they're going to be like, so, you know, how did you Google stuff before there was a computer? Like, they're going to have no idea. And these are just the ideas we have now because of how much, like, Google has impacted my life. But, like, what kids are going to have in the future, what you're all going to invent, what your grandkids are going to invent. I'm super long on software. I'm super excited by it. I think it's going to become like water, electricity. Like, electricity is a better example. It's going to be like electricity where something that just is, like, powering everything else we do, and then eventually software is not going to become the exciting thing anymore. It's going to be the stuff that we do with software. And hopefully I've made the point, and I think we try to make this at GitHub, is like GitHub's never going to become a name brand that everyone in the world knows, and that's fine, because what we're trying to do is lift up all those name brands. And I think that's the same thing for software. Right now there's a lot of excitement around software. I'm personally really interested in it. Development tools and Swift, and this is all really cool. But at the end of the day, all that matters is what people are building with software, and I think that gets more exciting every day. So I don't know what's going to happen in 10 years with software, but I know like it's too late to go back, and I think it's going to become more and more entwined with how people live and interact with each other, and to me that's the stuff that is the most exciting thing.
On that note, thank you so much for being
thank
here.
You.
That was Chris Wanstrom, CEO and co-founder of GitHub. Next time, learn how artificial intelligence is changing the way humans and machines collaborate, and what this new collaboration could mean for the future of our society. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of CHM Live Radio. This podcast is produced by Chanel Loren and me, Lauren Miyamoto. John Plute composed our intro music, and transitional music is provided by Lee Rosevere. You can learn more about our events and the museum at computerhistory.org.
This program was brought to you by the Computer History Museum.